We are presently studying the first chapter of Pirkei Avos, the seventh Mishnah. We discussed the sixth Mishnah, but let's just briefly recap the words of the sixth Mishnah, Yehoshua ben Prachya. The next of the pairs are Yehoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Ho'arbeli. We discussed a little bit the time that these two great giants lived in. Difficult persecutions they faced in the era of Yanai HaMelech and his wife Shlomtzion. And Yehoshua ben Prachya, although he was forced to flee to Egypt and lived in a difficult circumstances, nevertheless, his is a message of positivity. Asei lecha rab, or knei lecha chaver, vehevedonis kol adam lekav zchus. And we talked yesterday about the idea of asei lecha rab. Make yourself into a rab. Each of us has the power to influence our environment. But first we have to have a solid sense of direction. Asei lecha rab in its simplest sense. Make yourself a teacher. Establish our fundamentals. And once we've established our fundamentals, then we can have a chaver, a good friend, to reinforce that. And then we can go out and change the world. Judge everybody to the side of merit. Mm-hmm. You know, today, the word fundamentalist is not a good word. You're associated with Khomeini-style people. But we Jews are fundamentalists. We do have fundamentals that we cannot dilute. There are fundamentals in life that we're not willing to compromise. There is a mission and a purpose in life. There are fundamentals of our existence. A fundamental is something that we don't compromise on. And without fundamentals, we're really not grounded. We're floating. Everything is okay. We're not rooted. So the first thing that we need is asei lecha rav. Make for yourself a rav. Know from where we're coming from. There's a chain linking us back to Har Sinai. So we're anchored. We're stable. We know where we're coming from. Then when we know where we're coming from, we can reinforce it and help others as we travel towards our destination. Those were the words of Yehoshua ben Prachya. Now we're going to read the words of Nitai Ho'arbeli, his counterpart, who's always the opposite energy, like the battery, the positive, and now the negative. Nitai Ho'arbeli is going to tell us how we exercise discipline in our interpersonal relationships. What does he say? Mishnah Zayin. Harcheik, stay far away, mi shochein ra, from an evil neighbor. Don't live near somebody who is bad, because a neighbor influences us. As the Rambam in Hilchos Deis tells us, that the greatest influence on our behavior is our peers. They have the greatest motivating and influencing factor. They have the strongest ability to change us, because we want to be accepted by our peers more than anything, by our neighbors. And therefore, harchek, stay far away, mishachan ra, from a bad neighbor. Because when we see people doing bad things and nothing happens to them, we develop an immunity towards it. Our senses are numbed and it's easy for us to slip into that mode of behavior. Harchek, stay far away, mishachan ra, from a bad neighbor. Even though you're well-intentioned and you want to make a chava, a friendship with someone who is evil because you think you can influence them for the good, but nevertheless, al tischaber, do not be a close friend, larasha, to an evil man. Don't make yourself a best friend with a guy thinking that you're going to help pull him out of the quicksand of his life, because it won't work. Don't be a chava to a rasha. Ve'al tisyo'esh min ha'puranus. Do not give up hope from punishment. Don't give up hope because you think, anyway I am doomed, anyway I am going to Gehenim. What does it matter anyway? Not a good way to think. Let's analyze each of these three things and we'll talk about them in a little more detail. First and foremost, Nitei Ho'arbeli tells us that we are to stay far away, mishachan ra. And this is echoed in the words of the Chazal, in the words of the sages. Oy la rasha, oy lishchena. Woe to a wicked man, woe to his neighbor. We're not supposed to be the neighbor to a wicked man. Question. I live in my little estate. He lives in his little estate. There's a fence, a nice fence with bushes, with trees. I never see him. He doesn't see me. It's true, he's driving in with all kinds of seedy characters with his nice car in the wee hours of the night. But I don't see him. Don't ask, don't tell. That's his life. This is my life. So what's wrong? And here there is a deeper concept than what we've talked about from the Rambam. On a basic level, yes. I develop an immunity. I'm affected naturally, subconsciously, by the people with whom I'm associated with whom I live. But even if I don't see them, and even if I am not engaging them all the time, nevertheless, there is a deeper, more sublime effect. And as we've said many times, just like the spiritual world mirrors the physical world. In the physical world, we know that there is a concept of germs. Fascinating. Germs travel. If you're across on the other side of the room and you have bad cold and you sneeze, it's all too likely that the following day I will come down with something. Flu travels. There are bad germs in the air, in the atmosphere, invisible to the naked eye. We don't see them, but they're there. So if someone's sick, I don't want to be in their close proximity. The more toxic, the more potent, very serious diseases, the Ebola, God forbid, some very strong diseases, are so contagious that we have to stay far, far away, and we have to protect ourselves in every which way possible to make sure that we don't become contaminated, because it spreads very fast, like that. Well, in the spiritual sense, it's the same way. When I am in the close proximity of someone who is thoroughly wicked, hard to believe, hard to understand, but there is invisible negative germs in the environment. And so, it's a concept. I'm just presenting to you an idea which is worth thinking about. But there's a concept in the Zohar and in the spiritual books that talk about how we are affected by the spiritual vibrations in our environment. There are certain things that subconsciously we feel, even though it's not visible to the naked eye. Have you ever tried in the Manhattan, 42nd Street? Sometimes I'm walking around in the street, it's a hot summer's day, and I got to daven mincha. And I'm walking around, and then I walk into a shul to daven mincha. It's like coming out from a hot sauna into a cold shower. It sends a chill down your spine because you're coming into a place from the street into a place that's full of kedusha, that's sanctity. You sense a certain difference. Coming in from the week to Shabbat, there's a certain sense of a transformation. The atmosphere, the air is different. It's a different air. Similarly, in a wicked man's house, in a seedy establishment, the air, the oxygen that I'm breathing is not spiritually rich. It affects me subconsciously. And therefore, the sages say, don't live in an environment where people are doing bad things. When we do live in an environment where people are doing good things, subconsciously we are affected. Fascinating. It just is. You know, we read in the Torah that at the beginning of creation, 10 generations after God created the world, was the era of Noah. Noah and the Great Flood. And we are used to these images that we have in kindergarten of this big boat floating on the water with a giraffe head sticking out and the elephant's trunk and a nice cute old man pulling in the ducks and is floating on the water, and there's this funny idyllic scene in the background. Obviously, when we read the text and we discuss it a little bit, we ponder it a little bit more, we realize that something much greater had taken place. God says, "Vatimoleh ha'aretz chamas," the world has become sunken in iniquity, in sin, and I have to destroy the world. "Vatishaches ha'aretz," God says, he destroyed the world. The world we have today is a completely different world. than the world before the flood, because there were such glacial forces, there was such volcanic energy that coursed through the earth's surface, so much so that it was unrecognizable. And the sages tell us, Rashi writes, it's clear in the verse, that God uprooted the whole world as far as the influence of man extended itself, until Gimel Tfachim Shel HaMachareish, until three Tfachim, the depth of the plow, that's 18 inches down, the world was churned up. It was a different world. So, I'm not going into the science versus creationism and how that affects everything, but the world was completely bathed in this huge mikveh. We don't know how, what kind of a geological effect that had, of a world bathed in water for 9 months, a year, whatever it was. Churning hot water. Who knows? But the world was destroyed. Question. If the whole world was bad and Noah was the good guy, why didn't God just simply zap all the men that were bad and all the animals that had corrupted their ways, kill out all the dinosaurs that were cohabiting with one another and not doing God's will, as the sages describe the world before the flood, and just leave Noah and start again? Why do you have to destroy the whole world? Horrific. The commentaries explain. You know, there was a great sage called Rabbi Eliezer Lapian. He passed away in about 1958, I think, 1960. Wonderful, great man, lived in Israel. Passed away, he was almost 100 years old. One of the great Musa luminaries. But he writes in one of his books, fascinating, when he was a young man, he lived in the town of Kelm. And in Kelm, in Eastern Europe, he said there was a hospital that was in the town for 200 years. I don't know, a long time. 250 years. The problem with this hospital was that when they brought in sick patients, they came in with a minor ailment and they contracted all kinds of diseases. It was known as the death hospital in Polish. It was terrible. They couldn't figure out, like, what is wrong with this place? People would come in with small sicknesses that could be healed, could be cured, and before long they got very, very sick and they died. And they brought in a team of experts from Warsaw, the big city at the time. And these experts, it was just after Florence Nightingale, during the Crimean War, had discovered the potency of germs and hygiene. And these experts told the hospital management, they said, look, what's happened here with this hospital is that over the years, 200 years, so many people have come in with serious sicknesses, the walls have absorbed the germs. And even if you wash the walls and scrub the floor, the walls are so saturated with germs, there's nothing you can do. Everyone has to move out the hospital. It's like nuclear waste material. It's contaminated. It's got to be uprooted and buried. Take the whole hospital, bury it, build it afresh. They built a beautiful new hospital, and sure enough, it was clean, everything. Sure enough, people were restored to their health in the hospital. It was like a regular hospital. Sometimes, nuclear waste. There's nothing you can do with it. There's no way you can detox it. You got to put it out in Utah Mountain, in the Yukon Mountain, somewhere in Nevada, someplace. No other way. Deep beneath the sea. And that was the world before the flood. It had absorbed so much negative physical, spiritual, physical, materialistic energy that God said, just killing the people and allowing Noah to live wouldn't do it, because Noah wouldn't have a chance to start again. The whole world had to be uprooted, bathed in a mikveh for 40 days. It rained 40 sa'ah in a mikveh. It had to be completely as if it was being reforged and recreated afresh. Fascinating. So sometimes something can be so corrupted that it's not easily detoxed. And a rasha, a wicked person, actually affects the environment in a way that affects the people around him. The environment absorbs the energies of the people that use it. That's why people pay a lot of money for articles that belong to a great tzaddik. Have you ever heard that? You know, you go to auction today, you can get a cup that was held by the Rishna, or a sefer that belonged to the Vilna Gaon. Very valuable. Why? Because if he used it, there's some good vibrations there. It's special. It's got some good energy there. That's the idea. It's a concept. It's not something that you can explain even, but it's there. You know, we are so spiritually numb that we don't sense the level of our environment. Great people have like an internal barometer that they're testing the spirituality of an environment. They can sense it. The Chazon Ish, great Chazon Ish, passed away early 60s, late 50s. He lived in Bnei Brak. He used to, in his older age, would take a walk around the block every day because his doctor told him he's got to take a walk. And people would vie for the honor of walking with the Chazon Ish because it was an opportunity to ask him anything he wanted. My uncle once, as a bacha in Israel, he walked the Chazon Ish. It was something he remembers the rest of his life, what he asked the Chazon Ish in the walk, the daily walk around the block. Once he was walking around the block and he stopped at a street corner. He said, "It's so good here. It smells so good." And he stopped a couple of minutes, then he walked on. And the fellow that was walking with him was a little surprised because he didn't see anything good in the street corner. He couldn't figure it out. After he took the Chazon Ish home, he went back to the corner and he looked around. He couldn't see anything. He went over in the corner, there was a kiosk facing the corner, a little like a cigarette, like a little kiosk. And he said to the owner of the kiosk, he said, "Was there anything going on here at this corner? Anything happened?" He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "No, the Chazon Ish, when I walked by, he stopped here. Something must have happened here." He said, "I don't know what you mean. Think." So he said, "You know, the only thing I could think of was that lunchtime, about half an hour before the Chazon Ish walked around, there were two boys from Panovich Yeshiva that stopped at this street corner and they were talking and learning for like three quarters of an hour. They were going over the Shiva of the Rosh Hashiva and they were discussing it. It was beautiful to watch. But that was before the Chazon Ish even came here. That was like half an hour before he came here. He could sense something lingering in the air. There was Kedusha. There were two people that were oblivious to their surroundings and engaged in Torah at that spot. He could sense it, feel it. It was good. Great people, it says, Moshiach will come, Behirichoi Bereich Hashem. He will smell the smell of Hashem everywhere. He'll be able to detect. He can look at a person and just smell, just, this is a person that's engaged in Torah and mitzvahs. He's radiating good energy. It's a scent, it's not a physical scent, like perfume or body odor. That's not what it is. It's soul odor. And it smells good. That's what it is. Just like there's positive energy, there's negative energy. It's well known. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, when he came to New York, very well known, he was traveling, this was in 1938, and someone was taking him. In those days, they didn't have the FDR Drive or the West Side Highway. You had to get from the top of Manhattan to Brooklyn, you had to go through Fifth Avenue, and he was coming down Broadway in a car. He didn't know English, he didn't know anything. He was sitting in the back of the car reading a sefer, and the guy was driving him from Washington Heights, from the top of Manhattan through to Brooklyn. As they were driving through Times Square, Rabbi Elchanan screamed in the back. He said, "Get me out of here. It smells. I can't stand it here. There's Gehenna coming out from under the ground." Now, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, the driver said over, he said, I drove. I put the pedal to the metal. I got out. But how did he know? He didn't know anything about Manhattan. Didn't know New York from anything. But he could sense. He could smell and sense an environment. He could feel it. You're talking about people that were on a different spirit. They had an internal spiritual sensitivity level because they were so attuned to that. That's the level that they were operating on all the time. They were connected. Broadband streaming live to the heavenly throne. And any interruption in that flow, they can sense right away. And if they're cut off from their oxygen supply from the heavenly throne, if they feel stifled, they can sense it right away. So that's the importance of a good environment. It's very different being here in the yeshiva than being out there on the street. And it's not just because in the yeshiva we're exposed, you know, we're protected, we're not seeing bad things. There's something in the air that's more conducive to the good.
Smells
good, thank you. It's soul smell, but it's better. It's conducive to the right thing because people are doing Torah and mitzvahs and the energy in the atmosphere is invested positively.
Sure.
That's the idea. So harchek mishachan ra, that's the first thing. Stay far away, mishachan ra, even if we're not going to be necessarily influenced by him, but stay far away. But one second. I have a mitzvah of kirov rechokem. I'm supposed to go out, outreach! I'm supposed to help. The guy's wicked, so I want to make him into a tzaddik. Yes. I am. But I'm not supposed to be best buddy with him. There are two types. No real outreach. No real successful outreach. You know what it is? Being a good role model. The best way I educate my children, it's one of the hardest things for parents. Don't preach. Lead by example. Extend love and warmth and goodness and acceptance and be a good role model. Because if I daven properly, and my kids feel close to me, they're also going to want to daven properly. But if I'm standing over them and saying, where's the place? Where's the place? No, you didn't read it properly. No, you can't go out. They're going to resent prayer. It's going to become onerous. Not a good role model. Outreach is not telling people necessarily what's right and what's wrong. Certainly not if they're not asking. Being a good role model. But it doesn't mean that I have to be a chaver. I have to be connected and open to people who are wanting and desiring goodness. But a rasha, someone who is positively evil, the altis chaver. Don't make yourself a chaver. If someone indicates they're interested in change, they're in growth mode, they're no longer a rasha. So they're going in, walking, they're traveling in a different direction, then I can be close. But a rasha, someone who's rasha, I need to be a good role model, that's all. You want to change? Here I am. But al tischaber l'rasha. Someone who is a rasha, al tischaber, don't become his chaver. Don't become his close friend. Because if I'm linked to him, if I become a chaver, if there's a real connection, inevitably I too will be influenced by him. Yes?
How would you define a rasha?
Huh?
How would you define a rasha? Somebody who doesn't keep
mitzvahs
and is not interested in changing? Or?
A rasha is someone who willfully desecrates Torah. Who willfully is not in growth mode. Is not interested or receptive in hearing and growing and finding meaning and purpose in life.
Not scared to say.
Huh?
Also not scared to say.
Not scared to say
it.
Ignorance is understandable. Tenuk shenishba. That there's an ignorance and there is someone who says, I want to be ignorant. I don't believe. There's hedonistic. Live today because you're going to die tomorrow. Don't tell me. I'm not interested. Then there is an ignorant person, but who's interested in hearing, who's open to listening, who wants to be good, who wants to grow. So that's the central guideline. But the third thing, and this is the most important thing for us, is the al tisya'esh min haperonius. It's forbidden for us to give up hope because of punishment. Because our natural response to the responsibilities of life are, what do we say? Oh gosh, I'm going to get punished anyway. I'm no good anyway. That's what children say to parents. That's what we say to God. Okay, I'm no good anyway. What's the use? If I'm no good anyway, I might as well live it up. If I'm going to Gehenna anyway, I might as well live it up. there's an old Yiddish saying, "Am est chaza, lazus rinnen fin moel." It's a horrible saying. Terrible saying. It's not true. But anyway, the saying goes, if you're going to eat pork, let the juice dribble from your mouth. In other words, if you're going that way already anyway, you might as well enjoy it. Now, obviously, we know that the more you enjoy it, the more problematic it becomes, the harder it is to get it out the system down the road. But that's an attitude that people have. I'm going to get raked over the coals anyway. Hashem doesn't like me anyway. If you don't like me, so I'll do what I want. There's a subconscious, subtle human rationalization of negative activity that all of us have. Tell one of my kids to sweep the floor. I said, I told you already 3 times. Your job is to sweep the floor. Why didn't you do it? So they may become a little indignant. Okay, so, you know, I can't do it anyway, so what's the use? It's a natural response. You don't believe that I could do it anyway, so what's the use? It's a natural response to absolve ourselves of responsibility. And there's a very big temptation to give up forward motion. I looked at the top of the mountain. It's just unscalable. It's so hard. I give up. Many of us give up in life. We give up. And the reason why we give up, we need to have some kind of rationalization why we're giving up. And we say, well, we're not going to succeed anyway. We're going to get punished anyway. We say in tefillah every morning, Perseches Yudecha, God, open up your hand, Umaspia, and satiate L'chol Chai, all living creatures, rotten with desire. And the commentaries say, the most important element of life is the will to live, the will to engage and embrace life, the will to succeed. Because as strong as that will to succeed is, that's how successful we will be in life. And the same that the rule that applies in the business world and in the world of a career or an organization. If we want to succeed in an undertaking, we have to be committed to it and we have to have the desire and the will and the drive and the energy and the courage and the confidence. It's the same in the spiritual world. And that we can easily give up by saying, well, I'm going in the wrong direction anyway. Don't give up because of punishment. It's essential and fundamental to Jewish belief. There was a great tzaddik, the Kabrina, who once wrote, the most beautiful thought. He said, even if a person has committed the most heinous crimes, the worst sins, he says, even if a man seduced a married woman and lived with her, if he can't afterwards go into the synagogue, open up the ark, and cry out his heart to his Father in heaven, he has not even crossed over the threshold of what it means to be a Jew. Because to a father, there's always a way back home. Very important. We'll touch upon this a little bit more tomorrow, and then we will forge ahead in our study of Pirkei Avos. A Mishnah a day keeps the doctor away. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
How would you ask your kid when he says, I can't do it anyway, would you tell him?